Hi everyone, welcome to the Curve Mindset Podcast with McGinley Coaching. I'm your founder and host, Laurie McGinley. Today we're joined by Marcus DiBernardo, or Coach D. How are you, Marcus?
Doing great, thanks for having me on.
Can you just tell the listeners a bit of background about yourself?
Sure, I'm over here in America. I base myself out of New York City. I work pretty much all levels of the game. I run a youth club with maybe 38 teams and 500 rec players. I've coached, again, at almost every level here. My main job is I'm a university coach over here. So we actually have a large number of international players that we bring across. And I've been coaching in college for maybe 20-plus years. But my real passion about, you know, the game, it really comes into coaches' education and more specifically tying in academic theory to practice session design. That's really where my passion lies.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting because that's we talk about when it comes to the kind of methodology. Everyone's got a methodology or a philosophy, but it's usually backed up by theory or practical. But you said the majority of your time you're obviously doing university work and working with international players. That must be really tricky when you're trying to explain, you know, different exercises to players who might have a different way of thinking or a different way of communicating with you.
Yeah, I mean, listen, it's not so easy, right? Because I have 8 kids from Japan, very limited English. I might have 7 from Brazil, maybe 1 from Scotland, and, you know, all over the world, really. And here's the thing about my methodology. I really don't have to explain it. They have to come in, and they have to live it. Because I'm responsible for creating the environments, and I'm in a real-time feedback loop with my team assessing. I'm not coming in all the time with preset coaching points and topics that I need to get across. I am going with the flow, and I'm very flexible depending on what's happening in that situation. And the game is universal. And verbal, for me, verbal communication is highly overrated in a sense. For me, principles of play mean nothing to the players. You know, Toronto FC had 16 attacking principles of play. Giovinco didn't speak English. He didn't know one of those principles of play. And on day one, he was their best player. So I often think that some of this is a little bit for the coaches, and it doesn't matter as much for the players. Obviously, it helps to be able to communicate verbally, but verbal is not a great way all the time of teaching, because the kids do their learning while they're in the environment. The coach isn't responsible necessarily for their individual learning.
And do you think, from the experience that you have working in youth development, you know, working at the younger age groups, the older age groups, what do you think is the kind of base learning, or is it dependent on the team you're working with?
So for me, I start off with this, and it changes through the age groups a little bit into my college teams and so forth, but everything is about coupling your physical actions to real information. And when I say real information, I mean, am I dribbling through cones? That's not really real information, because cones don't move. It's not indicative of the game. I don't have to change my intentions. I don't have to adapt my movements, all that. But if I'm going to dribble and somebody's trying to tag me at the youth level, now I have to change direction, change my intentions. It's more game representative. Everything that I do, I try to make maximum meaningful decisions on and off the ball. So when a player comes to a training session, how many meaningful decisions on and off the ball did that player make? It's massive for me, whether you're talking U8 or university level, pro level. And besides that, the meaningful decisions is I try not to separate the game as much as I can into pieces. I try to keep it as whole as possible. And whole as possible means all 4 phases of the game hopefully can be incorporated. And however, like we can get in all kinds of discussions about, hey, listen, a Rondo isn't real. It doesn't have all four phases of the game. For me, soccer is about learning how to exploit time and space. And an old school definition of a 6'2" Rondo with guys on the outside, not moving, not counter pressing, no counter goals, no nothing. All right, there's limited value because the information, it's you're not going to progress from there. But if you want to take Guardiola's 4v4 plus 4, you know, Rondo, and there's tons of variability you could put in that, is it real? Yeah, it's real. You're learning to manipulate time and space against real defenders who are trying to press you, and then again, you're going to counter press. Even though you're not necessarily going to goal, it doesn't matter, in my opinion. It's still game representative enough. And, you know, you'll hear people, oh, but Rondo, you don't do the, you know, real scanning like you would in a game. Yes, you do. If you're one of the two players in the middle in you know, whatever, 5v5 plus 5, whatever you want to do. So that would be kind of the way I look at my training sessions. I always ask myself those questions. But you also have to say, as you go up in level, workload plays a factor, because every time it's game representative and people are on the ball and it's realistic, there's a chance for injury and there's a higher workload. So it's not realistic to do it the day before a game and so forth.
Yeah, because see when we talk about decision making, you know, I know you've got a lot of things on kind of YouTube and podcasts, and it's really started really diving into this more, the kind of constraint slide approach and dealing with, you know, how to make training more difficult for the players. So therefore, when they come to the kind of games, it's actually second nature. But do you think that as coaches, we are coaching the individuality or the decision making out of the children and youth, or do you think it's slightly different where you are? Just because when I try to do a session, I like to bed the question, the principle in, and then therefore when things go wrong, we try and make it a decision not for them. We'll give them different options, but then therefore there might be three options, but the fourth option is actually something they've thought of. Do you think that makes the players better? Or do you think the coaches are starting to just take over due to ego and also due to maybe the players are outthinking the coach a bit more?
Well, I mean, it's a really good point. I do think there's a balance here. And becoming a really good coach, in my opinion, it's not easy. So if you to say the game is the best teacher and, you know, just guide them through, create the environment, you know, it's too simplified, of course. So what I would say is it comes down to, and let's relate this back to academic theory, it's about perception, right? And this is all visual. So if you open their eyes up by saying, listen, maybe the other side of the field is wide open and we have a 1v1 on the other side of the field and we're outnumbered where the ball is. If you make that player aware by, we could call it attuning them, where attunement in ecological dynamics is basically, think of it as a radio wave. And if you tune that kid into that, oh yeah, now they see the player on the far side of the field and they say, okay, they perceive that. Once you perceive that, now you could lead to an action, an affordance. Like, what ability for action does that kid have? So you're not actually telling that kid, hey, you have to play to our number 6, the number 6 will play to our number 8, and the number 8 is going to play it out wide. That's the principle of width, and that's the principle that we're training today. No, all you have to do is attune them, change their perception, and let them solve the problem how they want to solve it. You're just making them aware of it. And I think that's pretty cool, because there's a million different ways to solve problems in soccer, and really is about exploiting time and space to score or shutting down time and space to defend. And when Messi has the ball, you and I don't know what he's capable of. So for me as a coach to come up with solutions in all areas of the field for somebody like Messi, or actually any player, to be honest, I don't know what he's going to do. I don't know what he's capable of. So at that point, the affordance is, they open up and they shut down in real time. That's up to Messi to decide. But you still have to have a game model or a structure. But for me, it's all about a very flexible structure where individuals.
Sorry, Marcus, I think we lost you there. Must be the heat where you are in New York. Can you just repeat what you were saying about Messi and the individualism?
Yeah, listen, I mean, here's the thing, is that because every player has different affordances and different abilities, like if you take a Red Bull game model, right, which I call the energy drink game model, it limits, in my opinion, because it's so strict, it limits decision making. And because everything is about, listen, let's keep a narrow shape. We don't care how the ball gets down the field, but let's get it down the field. Let's hit it to the top of the box. Let's win second balls and counter press. What is the real decision making there? So you have to be really careful because we're talking youth development. You got to let kids explore. And for me, that's going to hinder youth development if you're a coach who sticks to like a real strict game model. Because I always take this opinion, like, does the coach have all the answers? Or maybe will the players in the moment have a better answer than the coach? And if they do, do you allow them that flexibility to execute that? And in my opinion, I want to allow them the flexibility.
Yeah. And see the when we talk about kind of the constraints, like, you know, there's different parts to it, like the kind of task, environment, individual. Do you think the best thing to, when working with young kids, you know, and obviously working with adults too, is to push them, you know, so they can learn how to make mistakes? But it's not about me. If you make a mistake and people say, oh, you make a mistake, you got to learn from it. But you need to be maybe once or twice that the kid will learn from it, or the adult. But then if they're not taught a different way, you know, like you all talk about, you know, different parts of learning and visualising, you know, to verbal. But do you think the best thing to do is let them make the mistake and work out what's the best solution for them, and then coach them to what's best for their learning to develop themselves a bit more?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting because soccer is such a dynamic game, and it's hard to, like, I worked on a golf course when I was a kid, and I would see the golfers come out, and they'd be members for 10, 15 years, and they'd have the same crappy golf swing and play the same crappy way and not be very good. And if somebody had given them lessons and they really worked at it, they would improve, in my opinion. So I know what you're saying, and I almost think that in soccer, the coach can't give lessons to come up with solutions to every problem the kid is going to see. That's not realistic. That's never going to happen. The idea of practice and exploration, like, exploration is massive for me. So they can kind of learn, like, oh, maybe this works. And so, but also for me, playing with other really good players helps. It could change their perception as well. Constraints are massive to change perception. And there's a whole bunch of different ways for me. Constraints are, say I want to teach a 7v7 game model, and I'm going to use it to teach positioning, to start with the ideas of positional football. Okay, well, I divide the field into three lanes. When I roll the ball on the field, three defenders come out. The six attackers who are going to go into their positions have to get into the lane that designates their position. Now the constraint is teaching them the basics of positional football. You could do the same thing to teach them the basics structure of defensive organization, all through constraints. It's not going to teach them the fine details, your body position, you know, all that kind of stuff. But at least it's taking care of a large amount of the learning there so they can experience that. That's one idea of a constraint. But you could use other constraints in all sorts of different ways to I have a million constraints, right? You've seen, like, I'll do the peripheral vision blocking goggles. So now the players have to use much more head movement to scan. I'll do speed constraints, so the kids who are used to running by everybody now have to hold like this PVC stick in back of them with two hands. It takes away their ability to run by people, so now they have to have better body positioning. They have to think one and two touch. All that stuff is constraints, and it forces them to what? To change perception. If the attacking team can only play the ball on the ground and you don't tell the defending team, it changes perception of the attacking team. They have to figure out, how are we going to score when we can only keep the ball on the ground? So for me, constraints is a huge part of my methodology.
And do you think working on the constraints, but then working on the technical aspect, will improve the players then? So therefore, they're like, hypothetically, let's say there's a 6v6 plus 3, and the constraint is just 3 touch for one team and the other team on unlimited touches. But the 3 players in the middle only allowed to touch the ball once, you know, like one touch stuff, just to move the ball quicker. But the 3 in the middle, they're the most technical players, so therefore that would be a hindrance to them even more. But do you think working on, it's a weird, but having them develop the technical aspect will actually improve the constraint, so therefore the constraint can be a little bit more difficult, so therefore they can rely on their technical ability more, but then when it comes to decision making, they can rely on that a little bit more because it's speeder, you know, so faster, but also they can think about it a bit more, kind of decision making at a speed. Is that something you've been working on, you know, from your kind of time and working at university?
Yeah, for me, like, that's massive, right? Like, everybody needs to be comfortable operating in all sorts of situations. So I have small area positional possession, medium area, which becomes more game. Look, it can start to become more game model-ish, and then large area, which is game model. But you players have to be comfortable finding solutions in small, medium, and large areas. It's crucial for me. So my wingers aren't always going to train as a winger who's always going to have loads of space to take people on one-on-one out wide. He needs more than that. What happens if they have to break down a low block? I love the time constraints, you know, from you have 8 seconds to score. Completely changes your perception because it changes your action abilities. Those things are massive. Even I know you're talking about, you know, the technique. For me, technique is technique. Everyone thinks of now these supplemental trainers. Hey, we're going to, you know, they're going to build technique. They can train with the supplemental trainers. That's all technical. People forget that technique can also be developed between the relationship between the environment and the athlete. And there is no coach who can teach them that. So playing futsal, playing beach soccer, playing cage soccer, all those unique touches on the ball in Ghana on dirt and muddy fields, no coach can teach you that. That can only be taught by the relationship of the environment and the player. And so when we talk about building technique, that's if you had the ability to, I would have players play in sand. I'd have them do futsal. I'd have them do bumpy fields, variable bounce balls. All that stuff would be a massive part of it.
Yeah. And what about emotion? Because that's another thing. You know, you talk about, you know, the player, you know, they could have let's say you're having a bad day at school or, you know, or work, and your decision making becomes a bit erratic because of emotion, you know, working, you know, maybe a higher level or under pressure. But the player that you probably rely on is actually not performing as well. But do you think sometimes that's from like their skill level will just keep them going and they'll improve? Or do you sometimes have to actually say, take a step back for 2 minutes and then come back in when you not feel better, but you can understand that you can actually, you're more of a hindrance than a help in the moment? Do you obviously working at college level or university level, you've have probably had to deal with this many times. You know, I'm just wondering how you kind of deal with emotion and also a conflict.
Yeah, I mean, for me, that is, for me, it's a higher level question, but it also isn't a higher level question. One of the things that I learned early on from an educator when I first started off as a school teacher was you greet every kid as they walk in the door and say hello, not just to say hello, but to get in a reading on emotionally how that kid is doing that day, even before the lesson starts. And I make it a point to say hello to all my players, not just for that reason. I also really like my players, and I think that personal relationships are massive when you're a coach. But that's your first indication is something not quite right. And at that point, listen, I would say this, that, you know, if you're not connecting passes, simplify your game for the next 5 minutes and gain some confidence, connect some passes, and then let's get back into it. There was a guy, I'm forgetting the name, a basketball guy on YouTube who works with all the upcoming pro athletes. And he always talks about next play. And he's very, very good at this, about almost bringing that approach. If you're a great player and you can miss 15 shots in a row and keep shooting and not even be worried about the shot that you just missed, now you're a great player. And that means a lot. And I think that sort of mentality is a good one to have as a player. I almost prefer keeping things much more simple when it comes to a mindset than complicated. I in my youth club, I mean, we could debate this all, you know, I give this a lot of thought. Even I have an 8-year-old son. Is it youth club? You want to have fun. You want to make sure the kids play. You got to make sure they love the game. But and I don't really care about winning or losing at all at the youth level. But the kids do. And honestly, I'd rather win as a coach than lose. Even if I'm coaching 8-year-olds, I'd rather win. If you gave me a choice, I'd rather win. But all I care about is that they learn how to compete. And that's my mindset through the whole game, all the way up from 8 years old to professional. Every time you step on the field, you need to understand how to compete. Because even at 9 years old, I don't want you to waste your time by coming out and not being concentrated and not putting a best effort forward. So, yes, I want you to have fun, but not at the expense of not competing. And that's all I care about.
Now, let's look at the competing then, because as coaches, we always develop ourselves, you know, like I've got my own game model, but I like to, you know, I do a lot of reflection, you know, and I send it to maybe the trusted people that, you know, that are mentors, but also people who have been doing this for a long time, and they say, there's more detail here, this is good parts here, maybe improve this. But the biggest thing is why, you know, why do we do it? And that's always, I've been interested in the last maybe 5 to 10 years of, you know, the Simon Sinek, start with why, but also, you know, the tipping point from Malcolm Gladwell. You know, you talk about these, you know, these guys who talk about the 10,000 hour rule and all these kind of theories, but how do you improve yourself? How do you make yourself better? Because see, if you become stale as a coach, then the players will see right through that, you know, and then therefore, you know, you lose that relationship, that trust. How do you develop yourself as a coach to make yourself that a little bit better?
You know, it's a tough one because, I don't know, like, I am always trying to learn. I'm always trying to learn from other sports, from other coaches. Like, my son just started the Gracie Jiu-Jitsu. I watch the instructors. I watch how they learn. I see if the information is real. I don't say anything to the instructors. I just watch and try to relate it. Just like Guardiola, like his tactics, right? He watches the New Zealand rugby team and notices that New Zealand, everyone presses up on New Zealand and they try to high press them in rugby. And sometimes New Zealand was punting the ball 60, 70 yards down the field. And then they would go high press the other team, and it led Guardiola to rethink the first year he was in the Premier. Why am I putting six guys in around the box and trying to work out of the back every single time? And he's like, and that was one of the things that made him not work out of the back every single time because of what he learned from speaking to the New Zealand rugby coach. So I am always trying to think tactically from other sports. But I will say this, this is what this is somehow in my personality. Maybe I need a shrink to talk to me or something, but I cannot stand going with the accepted beliefs. I question everything. And for me, this is one of the reasons why I question KPIs. Like, okay, I question coaching licenses. Why is someone going to tell me how to coach? Or if they're not going to tell me how to coach, why do I have to live up to your KPIs? Why don't you fire Jurgen Klopp because he didn't live up to his KPIs in the last year and a half? So I'm a bit of a pain in the neck about that kind of stuff, because for me, wins and losses, it doesn't tell the story all the time, wins and losses.
Yeah, and that's really interesting, because that must be from, like, see when you talk about that high press or that over the top, that's probably why he bought Ederson in the second season, to picking that ball over the top. So therefore, you know, relating it back to football, you know, that kind of way of thinking, do you know what, I know that we're not very good at playing from the back at the moment, so if we get high pressed, we can put the ball over, you know, like if you get a goalkeeper like Ederson who can play as a, you know, a fly, yeah, you know, basically a guy who can ping a ball over the top. But the you talk about, like, question everything. Do you see when you question things, you obviously need to have the backup, the theory. Do you ever think from, like, an academic point of view that when you question things and you don't get the answer you're looking for, do you question it more, or do you think, I want to learn more about that? Because I've always learned my way is, if you don't know something, learn about it and then ask the questions to people who are knowledgeable, who know about it, so therefore they can give you advice, you know, and then theory, but you can learn about it in your own way and they can teach you, like, a different way, but you're still learning. Is that something you've been trying to do? You know, you question things, have the belief, and then learn about it from different people who are maybe have more knowledge than you, or have a better experience, yeah, in a different way.
Yeah, so for me, like, if I have the, I'm always talking to other coaches to get ideas from them, right? And, but at the same time, I interviewed a Shaolin monk. I interviewed, you know, one of the head masters in Aikido, and I want to know these things, because I ask them about training methods and practice session design and everything. Because I want to know, what can I borrow from them? And it was interesting. So I'm talking to a guy who was a master in Aikido, and their sessions are the same. Every session is the same. And I'm like, well, how do you get any better if every session is just the same thing? And he said, well, every 5 minutes, we change partners. So you could have a 6'5" partner where you have to work your technique, and then a 5'2" partner, and everywhere in between at different strength levels and balance and all this. And I said to myself, that's amazing. That's variability. That's adjusting movement patterns, movement solutions. And there it is. And what a great answer for me. So those things are things that I always think about. And I think about donor sports. I think about, you know, listen, box lacrosse in Canada. It's played in a hockey rink. And everybody develops these amazing skill sets that if they go on a regular lacrosse field, they can tell who was brought up playing box lacrosse. Arena football has changed the game of play calling and player development of quarterbacks in the NFL. So, like, these are things I absolutely pay attention to. Right now, a major focus of mine is differential learning, which is getting athletes from a technical perspective outside of their comfort zone of the normal range of motion, the stabilized range of motion and technique that they normally be in. And that's something I'm experimenting with now with my team and my son and even myself. And I'm going to have a lot of stuff coming out in the fall in video form on kind of how I'm going about doing that. And this is not a major, like, it's going to change your team, but all these things are important in a large scale.
Yeah, because it's actually interesting. You gave me two ideas already, you know, the New Zealand, you know, speaking to the coach, but also you talk about, you know, when the jiu-jitsu person, you know, like they were going, but it's like footballer, you know, like you could have the 6'5" defender against the 5'3" attacker, or it could be vice versa, you know, and then therefore it could be the 6'5", you know, a defender versus the 6'5" attacker. So therefore they learn how to, you know, hold their body weight, how to move, how to, you know, shift themselves. And it's just about, but then that's like maybe going into basketball, throwing the ball into someone off, you know, into the, you know, when they play at one combination work, you know, and it's different ways of thinking, you know. That's what I've been learning very quickly, that you can relate everything back to football or soccer, but what you need to look at is the other sports around it, which you can take from and then reapply it to maybe what the person learns about, you know. And obviously we all learn different ways, but I'm interested to, you know, hear that research more, you know, on this.
I mean, listen, one of the, I don't know if I gave you the example before of like the MLS final, like a couple years ago, Seattle against Columbus, and they had two goals against them. I think it was Seattle that gave up to two goals, and two goals were almost identical, right? And if this was not the final, if it was a regular season game, the next training session, that next week would focus on defensive shape. Shift left, shift right, step, drop. Boring as crap, right? And I guarantee you those players have been through that same training session once a week for the entire year. But it didn't change behavior. And here's what I would do. This is why I say you have to think about things in a different way. The center back didn't scan. He didn't see that there was someone at the back post who was wide open. They were focused on the ball out on the wing. So maybe I take my center back and I make him play once, twice a week as a center mid to increase his scanning. My right back didn't get back. He was stuck, and he left his man open on the back post. Why don't I make my right back play center back so he feels what it's like to not have your right back recover? Maybe you make that right back, you overemphasize the error. You make him, on transition, wait 5 seconds before he can recover. Maybe you make the defensive line shift way too far over to feel the error of having too much space to cover. So, like, these are things that you have to start to look at compared to, hey, this is the way I was coached, this is what my coach taught me, and this is the way I was brought up. That's, for me, that's not good enough.
Yeah, and just, it's about the make it realistic to the game, but also make it realistic to the players you've got, you know, and making sure that you trust them, because a lot of players, see, if they make a mistake, coaches don't trust them anymore, but then that could be because the coach has not actually taught them the right thing, or put too much detail in, you know, to the, you know, the smallest little thing, you know, like, for example, let's say you play with a back four, and you've got two left-footed centre-halves, you're obviously going to pressurise the one that's on the right-hand side more, because they're left-footed, so therefore that's where your trigger is. But again, small things like that, you know, like, you can tell that it's going to be like that. But, you know, I know I've taken half an hour of your time. I've just got one more question. You know, the channel you have, you know, on YouTube is very interesting, but see the coaching that you do, you know, you try to develop, is it just trying to just make people more aware that there is different ways of coaching, different ways of learning, so therefore people can, you know, cause this, you know, discussion and have this debate on differential learning and, you know, constraints-led approach and how it can actually benefit, but also, you know, help and, you know, hinder maybe sometimes, you know, the development of players and coaches.
What? You know what, I've noticed that, like, college soccer in America, you know, it can be, you know, they some of these facilities and some of the stuff is better than pro clubs. Like, it's ridiculous, the amount of money that's involved in college sports in America. I shouldn't say ridiculous. I mean, it's pretty cool, to be honest.
Yeah.
But what happens is everything's a big secret over here. No coach is willing to give insight into how they run their program. And even in the MLS, nobody's really opening up and saying, this is what we do. And I felt like, you know what, I'll just open up everything I do to every coach in the country around the world, and whatever they can find useful from it, great. And that's my view on coaching education in general is, listen, whatever you think is useful that you could bring into how you view the game, take it. It's great. There's no right or wrongs for me, but I do think you should be able to explain why you're doing things. And if you can't really make a logical explanation to why you're doing things, then maybe you have to think a little bit more about it.
No, I agree. But and people can find your it's on YouTube, isn't it?
It's just under my name. Yeah, it's under my name, Marcus DiBernardo, but it's also DiBernardo Soccer Methodology. I have Instagram. There's a lot of stuff on there, too. Take a look at it. And anyone who wants to reach out, CoachDiBernardo@gmail.com, feel free to reach out. I'm always happy to, give what I can to some of the questions.
Oh, perfect. Okay, thank you again, Marcus, for the time.
Oh, no worries. I appreciate you having me on.